This one was your idea, and you've chosen the by far the happiest New Year's Eve story I could possibly imagine. And so all our listeners would be thrilled to ring in the new year with incredible good cheer.
This is The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. New Year's Eve. What is it about New Year's Eve that makes it, for some of us, a little hard to take? A day weighted down by resolutions to make, promises to keep. A day that carries the expectations of portending what the next year will bring us. And within that weight and pressure are the wishes for prosperous times ahead. Luck, love, all good things. If only it were that easy, right? In Mavis Galant's story, New Year's Eve, we see that the idea of this last day of the year plays a part in the lives of these characters in pretty remarkable ways. Mr. and Mrs. Plummer are entertaining a young woman named Amabel. Their daughter Catherine died years before, and Amabel had once been her friend. Amabel is going through a divorce and wants to spend the holidays with the Plummers. They go to the opera. They don't know what it's about, don't know the players, and don't speak the language. And all of that seems emblematic of the ways in which they're facing their lives on this particular night. Mr. Plummer hasn't necessarily been true to his wife, and she has her own small secrets. They're finally at this stage in their marriage, well entrenched in routines. Amabel's inviting herself is a nuisance for them, as is her insistence that the last day of the year and what occurs then is somehow so supremely important. Whatever happens tonight happens every day for a year, she tells them. But the Plummers have been through a lot over the years. The idea of a New Year's Eve freighted with so much artificial importance will not be convincing for them, as it is for the 22-year-old Amabel. And yet, we see a glimmer of something. It happens in passing. It's something so quick and ineffable, almost imperceptible. It would be really easy to miss it if we don't pay attention. That's kind of how it is with Mavis Galant. But we see the ways the characters enter and exit the rooms of memory, come to discover the ways that doing so affects the present moments in that theater on New Year's Eve, and imagine, maybe still hope a little, what the new year can possibly bring. Here now, Peter Orner and I discuss New Year's Eve by Mavis Galant.
This story is set in Moscow, which is unusual. She has stories set in Germany and other places. This one's new to me. It's set entirely at the Bolshoi Ballet. It's fairly simple. You have a diplomat and his wife, and they are being visited in Moscow. I believe they're Canadian diplomats, and they are visited in Moscow by a old friend of their daughter, Catherine, who has died fairly recently of spinal meningitis back when they were stationed in Italy. And I believe that after Italy, they were moved to Russia. We're in the 60s, early 70s, maybe. So we're in communist USSR. And this woman, Catherine, decides that what she wants to do, because she's getting divorced, is visit her old friend's parents, who were always so welcoming to her in the past. So of course she apparently gets on a plane and flies to Moscow in the middle of December, late December. It's New Year's Eve, and they're at the Bolshoi Ballet, the three of them sitting, that they don't know what's really happening in the ballet, and we don't really either, and that's not necessarily important unless I miss something about this story. I cannot, if we try and explain this story, then we should just forget it.
Very true. But I do have a couple of things I want to point out. It's the section where Mrs. Plummer is telling Mr. Plummer about Amabel visiting them and what the wife is supposed to say back to Amabel about why it's just such a terrible idea for her to come. There are a couple of ideas I want to talk about. One is New Year's Eve and the idea from Amabel that whatever happens on New Year's Eve happens every day for a year. And the idea that Mrs. Plummer has about it, about New Year's Eve. But then also the section about when Amabel makes it known to the Plummers that she wants to come and visit them. And I wonder if you can read that section that starts one evening.
Sure. When you start the story, you have no idea what the hell's going on. And that is so wonderful about her trust that we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out eventually.
Yeah.
She's got to move forward with the story, and she's not, doing what, 95% of stories do, which is sort of like make sure that we're kind of, we kind of get it so that we can move forward. Gallant's like, no, there's two people, there's three people, they're at a ballet, and you'll figure it out. And this is like 5 pages in, and this is where you figure it out. Or at least she gives us some indication of why these three characters happen to be together tonight. And so one evening, his wife had looked up from the paperback spy novel she was reading at dinner, and having waited for him to notice she was neither eating nor turning pages, remarked that Amabel Bacon, who had been Amabel Fisher, that pretty child Catherine roomed with in school, had asked if she might come to them for 10 days at Christmas. Now, that's a 10 days? It's like a long visit of like your dead daughter's friend. That's what this is. She has decided that that's what she wants to do, and she's invited herself. Mr. Plummer, the colonel, says, "Nothing for children here," he said, "and not much space." And then his wife says, "She must be 22, and she can stay in a hotel." They stared at each other as if, and this is, I'll just read it. What can we say about it? They stared at each other as if they were strangers in a crush somewhere, and her earring had caught on his coat. Their looks disentangled. That night, Mrs. Plummer wrote to Amabel saying that they did not know any young people, that Mrs. Plummer played bridge from 3 to 6 every afternoon, that the colonel was busy at the embassy, that it was difficult to find seats at the ballet, that it was too cold for sightseeing. Lenin's tomb was temporarily closed. There was nothing in the way of shopping. The plumbers, not being great mixers, avoided parties. They planned to spend a quiet Christmas and New Year's, and Amabel was welcome. There's the, you could call it a setup. It happens very late in the story. And I would argue, probably long after some people have given up on this one. It appeared in New Yorker, I believe 1970. So, and by then, Gallant had 80, 90 stories in the New Yorker or whatever it was. And by that point, and so people probably, if they knew or trusted that something was going to happen, and they would get there. But I think for some people, they might have been like, I don't know about this one, and gave up, even though it's quite short. But here it is. This is the, she's come. She's has left her husband. The husband has not chased after her, apparently. And she goes to see the plumbers who were at one time comforting in her life, not so much anymore.
Yeah, and what is that other section where she imagines, Amabel imagines herself at the feet of Mrs. Plummer, where she says something like, let me see, why else had Amabel come all this way at Christmas time if not to be adopted? She had fancied herself curled at the foot of Mrs. Plummer's bed, Mrs. Plummer with a gray braid down on one shoulder, her reading spectacles held between finger and thumb. Her book, one of the thick accounts of somebody's life at Cambridge, the reading of the elderly, slipping off the counterpane as she became more and more engrossed in Amabel's story. That's another thing. There's this interesting shift in points of view in the story. Sometimes it's the colonel, sometimes it's Mrs. Plummer, sometimes we're in Amabel's head.
Yeah, that horrible creative writing-y question, like, whose story is this? I'd love to give this one and say, like, whose story is this? I mean, if this one is a threesome for sure. The story is everybody's, and maybe even the fourth narrator or even a fifth reader, I would add.
Yeah.
So, five. This is a five-person story.
And there's all this other stuff happening with those two other girls at the opera.
The longest piece of dialogue in the story is a stranger who is overheard by the colonel, Mr. Plummer, listening, overhearing their conversation. It's extraordinary. Oh man.
Can you read it?
Sure, yeah, and I would even argue, and I'm probably wrong, that this is an invention of Mr. Plumber, who has become both plumbers, and I think it's important to note, but not as a key to the story, is that they're both, they've lost a young daughter, and
Yeah.
so devastating, beyond devastating, right? And so they're both kind of living in their in isolation. Gallant uses this phrase. He is it's as if they're living in a block of ice, this couple. But he's really good with languages, which is why he's such a well-respected diplomat, apparently. And he's able to pick up languages. The colonel was able to learn the structure of any language, given a few pages of colloquial prose and a dictionary. His wife was deaf to strangers, and she barely noticed the people she could not understand. As a result, and I think this is, I just this sentence really just knocked me over. As a result, the colonel had grown accustomed to being alone among hordes of ghosts. With Amabel still mewing beside him, he heard in the ghost language only he could capture, "Yes, but are you happy?" And that's something that he's picking up from two women who are sitting in front of them at the theater. We should note that the story mostly takes place at the break, at the intermission, and both the plumbers are not the kind of people who get up at intermission, but they stay in their seats. It's one thing they agree on. And they agree on a lot, actually. The story's not as sad as it seemed on the first read, I think, to me, even though the second one just devastated me. Anyway, he hears these voices, these ghost voices, and this is what he overhears in that question, "Are you happy?" Does the colonel know enough Russian to have heard all this? I'm not sure. I think when Gallant says he listened to ghost languages, I think at least possibly he is translating language that he doesn't totally understand. But anyway, this is what he hears. "I'm 21 years old and I have not succeeded." And then he was wrenched out of the queue. This is after the ballet is over. He is kind of chasing after them in the coat line to try and hear the rest of to hear the answer to that story, to hear the answer to that question, "Are you happy?" That one woman asks another woman at the opera, and he's in the coat line and he's listening, and this is what the woman says. "Even though we went to a restaurant and paid for his dinner," said the same girl, who had not even looked around and for whom the colonel had no existence. "The next night he came to the door very late. My parents were in bed. He had come from some stuffy place. His coat stank. But he looked clean and important. He always does. We went into the kitchen. He said he'd come up because he cared and could not spend an evening without seeing me. And then he said he had no money, or he lost his money somewhere. I did not want my mother to hear. I said, 'Now I know why you came to see me. I gave him money. How could I refuse? He knows we keep it in the same drawer as the knives and forks.' He could have helped himself, but instead he was careful not to look at the drawer at all. When he wants to show tenderness, he presses his face to my cheek, his lips as quiet as his forehead. It's like being embraced by a dead animal. I was ashamed to think he knew I would always be there waiting. He thinks he can come in whenever he sees a light from the street." And then there's this line, "I have no advantage from my loyalty, only disadvantages." And then her friend says, "If you're not happy, it might be your fault." And then the coat room attendant gives these two girls their coats back, and woolen caps, and then the colonel's turn to get Amabel's coat, her jacket, and his wife's coat, and all that. But all that's in the coat check line, which I think is just remarkable.
And then what follows in the next part, where it says, what nagged at him was that disgraceful man. Oh, he could imagine him well enough, an elegant black marketeer speaking five languages, wearing a sable hat, following tourists in the snow, offering icons in exchange for hard currency. It would explain the watch and perhaps even the chocolates and oranges, because the girl's wearing a man's watch and they're eating chocolates and oranges in the theater. His coat stank, he quotes, and he looked clean and important were typically feminine contradictions of unequal value. And it goes on, and it's really Such an amazing part of the story, I think, because in the next moment, he says, he watches the girls holding on to each other's coats and putting on their boots and laughing and collapsing in each other's arms. This is unusual, he told himself. For when do people laugh in public anywhere in the North, not only in this sullen city? He thought, as though suddenly superior to the person he had been only a minute ago. What an iron thing it would be never to regret one's losses. It says,
Never that one's lost. Sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
it's just stunning, that part about him and how he's so captured by the girls and what they're saying, and then how he can turn it off, how he can turn off his reaction to them and be very rational about why are they laughing in a place like this, and and suddenly feeling very superior. It's like he's sort of willing himself not to feel any emotion about what he's just witnessed. And that's what he can do, this guy who shuffles from wife to mistress or whatever, and not necessarily check in with his wife after the death of the daughter. And there's just something with him, this idea about having this gift of languages and not being a very good communicator himself. And not receiving communication, really, except as somebody from the outside of whatever the exchange is.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but I'd also say if this story kind of landed there, like at Mr. Plummer's distance and inability to communicate, no one in this story has any ability,
No.
interest, and I think that's why what makes so startling this line, what an iron thing it would be never to regret one's losses. I mean that's the kick in the stomach line because it applies to everyone in the story. And and so Gallant, because she's always a moving target, can be harsh, but she's usually equal opportunity in her harshness. There's not a character that would necessarily stand out in her stories versus another character in terms of kind of the darkness, you know? Am I making any sense? Like I just she picks on everybody, always.
Even the parents of the plumbers, just in the memory, in the reverie of the plumber, of either plumber, it's sort of like the parents don't come away very well either.
Oh.
But I wonder about a couple of things. It's this weight that we put on New Year's Eve as being this determining factor of how the rest of the year is going to be. I'm thinking a lot lately about how a lot of Latin American cultures observe New Year's Eve. Like, you have to wear red underwear and you'll have a prosperous new year. Or you have to eat, I think it's a dozen grapes or something for good luck. And everything is sort of around this idea of prosperity and luck. But in the story, Amabel is worried about this. Whatever happens tonight happens every day for a year. But then Mrs. Plummer says, "The persistence of memory determines what each day of the year will be like," the colonel's wife decided, "not what happens on New Year's Eve." And then later,
Can I just stop right there for one
yeah.
moment? What's so just not to be annoyingly like crafty, but Amabel says that on the first page. It's like a paragraph. It takes four, maybe 3 pages for Mrs. Plummer to think that she's wrong and have this other idea about it. Oftentimes, what people say will kind of float around in our head for a while, for 10 minutes, for 15 minutes, or whatever it is, and then come back out sometimes as dialogue or sometimes here as just a thought where where she's like, no, that's not it. It's how you remember and what you remember that determines what each day of the year will be like.
Yeah.
Not nothing to do with New Year's. It has to do with how you remember on a given day determines what each day of the year will be like. It's a totally different idea. And it's one that just strikes to the core. Like how you remember on any given day determines what that day is going to be like. That's really something.
The other thing I was going to say comes later, and it's about memory, where it says the thing the colonel was most afraid of now was losing his memory. And so that's a fear for him. So it's just interesting the riff off of what happens tonight happens every day for a year versus it's the persistence of memory versus he's afraid of losing his memory. But you're right, this persistence of memory with Mrs. Plummer, because then she goes on, or her particular perspective goes on. This morning I was in Moscow. Between the curtains, snow was falling. The day had no color. It might have been late afternoon. And we're in first person. Then the smell of toast came into my room, and I was back in my mother's dining room in Victoria. And so she's recalling something really about the long past, where she says, a little girl I had been ordered to play with kicked the baseboard, waiting for us to finish our breakfast. A devilish little boy, Hume something, was on my mind. I was already attracted to devils. I believed in their powers. My mother's incompetence about choosing friends for me shaped my life, because that child who kicked the baseboard and left marks on the paint, dot, dot, dot. There's just something about where she makes this statement about memory and the memory that immediately comes to her mind at that moment. It's very interesting to me that it harkens all the way back to when she was a little girl.
And that determines that the way that this particular day is going, that memory, the memory of being in her mother's dining room, Victoria, is determining how this particular day, irrespective of it being December 31st or not, it's determining how this day is going. And you can see how it's playing out. She and her husband are, they're distant with each other as they normally are. You can kind of feel the fact that she is regretting a lot of her decisions in her life, as is he. And here she's literally regretting the decision for for her to marry the colonel. In another part of the story, the colonel regrets marrying her, Frances, her name is. And yet there's always these contradictions, and I don't want to generalize Gallant because there's no way to do that with any, and even though I just did it a few moments ago. But I always feel like once you feel like you sort of have the key to something, that's when you should feel most uneasy. Because I think most people might read the story and think, this is about a disaster. This is about the loss of a child and a couple that have no interest in talking to each other at all. And then this stray person enters their life for 10 days who is also kind of at a loss. And everything's at a loss. Bam, it's done. But there's this contradictory force in the story. And it's a particular moment where Mrs. Plummer, Gallant makes sure, she makes absolute certainty to make it uncheesy. But there is a moment where Mrs. Plummer reaches across. They're sitting, Amabel's in between them. So she reaches across Amabel to her husband. And they clasp hands for a moment. It's about the most unromantic, least passionate clasp you could ever imagine. But it is a clasp, and it is described as a conspiracy of love. The story just takes this, it takes so many turns. But just when you feel like this is a story about, basically, two kind of rotten people, and then a shallow friend of their deceased daughters. Like, that's how you could sort of on the surface on this one.
Well, what's so interesting too about the part you just referred to is it comes right after we learn that Mrs. Plummer is playing bridge every afternoon for money and saving this money. When she has enough money, she's going to leave, maybe leave him. When she had enough, she intended to leave him. Dollars, pounds, francs, crowns, lira, Deutschmarks, and goldens were rolled up in nylon stockings and held fast with elastic bands. But of course, she would never be able to leave him. And then comes the moment of the loving touch, or the clasp, and it's referred to here as the loving conspiracy. And then it appeared to Amabel a loving conspiracy. She was embarrassed because they were too old for this. Then she was envious, then jealous. She hated them for flaunting their long understanding, making her seem discarded, left out of a universal game. No one would love her the way the colonel loved his wife, which also I find such an interesting part of the story. She's 22, and but she feels like, oh, it's all over for her. And she's looking at the plumbers like they are just the symbol of matrimonial foreverness, eternity. It's very interesting to me. But it is true that the three of them are, as you said before, they're all in their own little bubble of isolation. They're all in their own sort of head, sitting there together, observing, watching the girl eat the orange, and all these things that are happening all around them that they sort of have in common in terms of what they're observing, but they all sort of observe it in such different ways. But in those moments where they can come together, it's usually around something like that, some kind of very superficial observation that, for instance, Amabel, who seems so naive most of the time, is witnessing. And then I think too about when they do mention Catherine and the things that Catherine is doing, it reminds me that the person who's sort of plunked down there in the theater with them, sort of, is Catherine. She is a ghost. She is somebody that sort of flits in and out of their consciousness, each person in turn, right? And it's just such an interesting thing that happens with the character of Catherine. And that too is uncheesy. That too is not depicted for us in a way to make it very sort of, mawkish or anything. Quite the contrary, I think. And it's sort of Amabel that comes off as the, this the it's sort of like Catherine did not live to see 22 years, but
Right.
Amabel doesn't act like a 22-year-old. I mean, there's this kind of interesting thing that's happening with her as a kind of a surrogate daughter sitting there with them.
Yeah, and like a daughter, they're also and they're separate, as you said, and they're separate universes. And I think that's what makes this such a glorious New Year's Eve story for people who hate New Year's Eve. And I find that most people hate New Year's Eve. I'm always suspicious of those people who like it, you know. Idea of just forcing yourself to like this arbitrary thing. I mean, I'm one of those people who's always just such a crank, you know. And Amabel's like, okay, here we're gonna set the tone for the new year. Here we are, the three of us, we're at the opera. You know, the two of them are like, oh, whatever, and we're just trying to live through this in a way. But then again, it shifts, it changes from that. The expectations of the story and the first two pages are flipped like multiple times.
Yes.
And you know, these people, you get their lives laid bare. You know, there was this moment where in Italy before Catherine's death, when the Mr. Plummer took off for a while. And this absolutely, for me, the most devastating lines in the story are after that. He walked away in Italy after a violent drinking quarrel with Catherine there in the house. Instead of calling after him, Mrs. Plummer sat still for an hour, then remembered she had forgotten to leave some money for the postman for Easter, which is great. She has this fight with her husband. The husband leaves, like and as if for good, and she remembers that she's got to leave money for the postman for Easter. Scribble the postman's name. And then there's this very mysterious dialogue here. Catherine in the garden on her knees tore out the pansy plants she had put in the little crevices between paving stones the day before. She looked up at her mother. "Have you had your breakfast?" her mother said. "It's no use chasing them," Catherine answered. "They've gone." And I remember staring at this a couple days ago for a while and being disoriented, not knowing what Galan was getting at. And even when she explains it, it still makes me think it's such a, "Have you had your breakfast?" her mother said. "It's no use chasing them," Catherine answered. "This is a kid talking. They've gone." That was how he had done it, the old shuffler, chosen the Easter holiday when his daughter was home from school down in Italy to creep away. And Catherine understood, for she said, "them." Though she had never known that other person existed, i.e., the mistress, apparently. Well, of course, he came shuffling back. because of Catherine. All was safe. Wife was there. Home safe, daughter safe, books in place, wine cellar intact, career unchipped. He came out of it scot-free, except that Catherine died. Was it accurate to say, serves you right? Was it fair? So this is after my take on the loving conspiracy. And she can make you feel like, oh, okay, well, these are two people that have this solid connection, that even though they don't no longer speak to each other, it's there. And then she under even cuts that later on, and I would argue it comes back, suppose, sort of in the end. It's like I can't believe how much is in a 7-8 page story, how like a roller coaster of distraughtness.
Yeah, I do want to go back to what you were saying before about New Year's Eve too. All of this pressure that we have to make a resolution or to whatever, to improve our lives or whatever, and it's so meaningless by January 1st. It's like what is it? Why are the stakes so high? Why do we put ourselves through this? Why do we mark the day the way that we force ourselves to mark the day? And anyway, but they're doing it too, because near the end of the story, this is after that line about the iron thing and regretting one's losses, Amabel says, "Only an hour left to change the year ahead," said Amabel without tact.
We always try and be against hyperbole, and I think you've been really good about it on this one, but I think I feel like I've violated the anti-hyperbole rule. Today I was just like, yeah, I was like, damn. I was like, this is a story written by somebody who does not give a shit what you think a story is and what works or doesn't work. So I cannot even imagine an editor saying, you know what, man, it's like, this one's really, I think you're onto something, but I'm not sure you got there. And I can just see her be like, I got there. I got there plenty.
Yeah.
If you think that it's not there, then you go to hell. I feel like, and it's the last story in this collection in transit. And I almost think like see again, it's like the story kind of turning people off, for some reason. Maybe I'm making too much of this. Like trying to imagine what other people might think of the story. But anyway, I just think like it shows the brilliant stubbornness of this writer, that she would have a story that has this much going on, at the opera, at the intermission, and then at the coat check, and that's basically it.
Well, and even after that, but also, it's such a funny, it's funny, but and then it's not funny.
Funny. Yes, it's hilarious in a very dark
But
way.
it also made me think a lot about the ice wagon going down the street. And when we talked about that, and I think you had said something like, people must be listening to this and saying, what are these two people talking about? And even in that story, you had the couple, Peter and Sheila, in that story, staying with the sister and overstaying their welcome. And I just think it's so interesting how she introduces like this extra thing in Amabel in this case. And she sort of dropped into the situation where these people are like, whirling dervishes in their own brains. Like, there's so much going on all around them and in their minds and in their memories and in their observations, or even in the lies that they tell themselves. And then Amabel is sort of the same way. So you're right. It's just like, it's a marathon. I mean, it's just such a short story, and you're just sort of confined mostly to this space. There's so much going on.
I love that idea, the story being a marathon, because it really does feel like that. And it is, and compared to Ice Wagon going down the street, this is, I mean, that's a crowd pleaser. That's a greatest hit. That's an anthologized. No one is picking this story to be anthologized. And in your New Year's Eve collection of stories, like, no way. I never heard anyone talk about it. Maybe I'm Maybe I'm not talking to the right people, but you're the one who mentioned the story, and it's the first time anyone has ever mentioned it, or that I've thought about it, even though the book has been sitting on my shelf for 20 years. For some reason, maybe I started it a few times and kind of had the reaction I was predicting other people might have. But to me, it is like, in contrast to Ice Wagon Going Down the Street, which is again is like a monumental piece of work and one of her most famous stories for good reason. This one seems like a weird outlier, but to me, I think arguably darker and more unsettling than more famous pieces by her.
Yes, even more unsettling somehow than Agnes Bruisen in Ice Wagon. It's sort of like this one has. I want to sort of put my finger on why I agree with you that this one's darker. I don't know if it's because Catherine is dead. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but there's, and Amabel is a little clueless and. And Mrs. Plummer has had this plan. She will never hatch to leave her husband, and he's so oblivious. And then he's so unbelievably fascinated with what some strangers are talking about.
Yeah, which is, makes him in some ways not oblivious.
Yeah, I know. It's just like these people are not ever just one thing. They're so, and that's what I love. I love this story. I also have never really talked to anybody about this story. I don't know anybody who's read this story or very much of Gallant. But also, we never talked about this comparison to the kitten mewing and the profile of the kitten, which is such a, it's not. I don't find it to be dehumanizing or infantilizing or. It's the way maybe a father describes a little daughter or something, or the way a mother describes a little daughter as a kitten. But it was so, it's at first I was so like, the first time I read it, and even recently when I read the story, I was sort of like, I don't know. But then it's not that. Plummer is a complicated guy. Who I think forgets himself, allows this idea to enter his mind that he's deathly afraid of losing his memory, like we all are, right? But he is really afraid of losing his memory. And yet he's someone that I don't know, that he doesn't outwardly have a heart for living in the past, at least in the same way that Mrs. Plummer seems to do.
It's just this swirling kind of like he doesn't want to lose his memory, but he's afraid to remember, and so and he's an eavesdropper, whereas Mrs. Plummer is not an eavesdropper. And I don't, maybe we haven't talked enough about her, but she's the, I think, the kind of beating heart of the story in so many ways, and that she's the one who, in the past, when they used to talk, what she would talk about was the past. And as she says, as we talked about earlier, like it's how you think about the past that determines your day. I mean, I just think that, to me, but again, these are not, maybe not people I'd want to hang out with. I do not envy Amabel sitting there saying, okay, here are three of us are now, isn't this great? And it's like, there's nothing great about it. I think it's worth saying, well, we'll read the end, because that's where it stopped. Only an hour left to change the year ahead, said Amabel without tact. The colonel knew that the city was swept by a Siberian blizzard and that their taxi would be nowhere in sight, but outside he saw only the dust of snow sifting past streetlights. The wind had fallen and their driver was waiting exactly where he had promised. Colonel Plummer helped Amabel down the icy steps of the opera house, then went back for his wife. Cutting off a possible question, she said, I can make a bed for her somewhere. Wait, he said silently, looking at all the strangers disappearing in the last hour of the year. Come back, he said to the girls. Who are you? Who was the man? Annabelle's little nose was white with cold. Though this was not her turn to speak, Mrs. Plummer glanced down at her guest, who could not hear, saying, he's not glad that he's going home. nor sorry that he has not had time to see the city. It's the sights of the city, I think, said the colonel. I'll look it up. He realizes he was not losing his memory after all. His breath came and went as if he were still very young. He took Amabel's arm and felt her shiver, though she did not complain about the weather and had her usual hopeful smile ready in case he chose to look. Laerty is happiness, he thought sadly, remembering those two others. Is it? Mrs. Plummer took her turn, remarking, used to read the same books, to no one in particular. Without another word, the plumbers climbed into the taxi and drove with Amabel back to the heart of their isolation, where there was no room for a third person. But the third person knew nothing about this. And so for Amabel, the year was saved.
New Year's Eve is a story by Mavis Gallant. This has been The Lonely Voice with Peter Orner. To learn more about Peter Orner and this podcast, go to tpr.org/thelonelyvoice. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.